Hello. As you may know, we've been discussing the 10 pillars that will be the foundation of the new American Constitution. And we have been on pillar number 8, which is the right to property. And we'll continue on that pillar in this snippet. And hopefully finish it so that we can move on to the next pillar, the ninth pillar. But before we do that, we would like to mention four things related to news stories that have or things that have happened, you could say, or things that have come to my mind over the last week related to the other pillars we have already discussed. And after we do that, we'll just do a quick recap of what we had shared previously about the right to property and then hopefully finish it up. One of the things that I noticed this week, the very day after we posted the previous snippet on the right to property, was this news story that came out, and as we've shared before, it's always interesting to me how the headlines seem to reflect very directly on things we have discussed in the snippets. It's as if they are reacting to what has been said. And this headline that I saw the very next day after the snippet went out, the previous one, was the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, which I'd rather call Lori Bigfoot. And not, I don't know how big her foot is, but I say Bigfoot because she is not quite, she's somewhere between animal and human. So this whore who acts as the mayor of Chicago, made some comments about an incident that happened in Chicago. I believe it was a Lamborghini store or place that got raided by looters. I believe they were black and just black thugs, and that is not a racist comment. It's just what's happening. And if you're black and you're listening to this, then you should feel sorrow, feel sadness, and try to do something to change it instead of feeling offended because it's a cultural issue. And this woman that I'm calling Lori Bigfoot is black as well. So these black thugs went into this, raided this Lamborghini place, and that's been happening a lot in America at the time of this recording because of the lawlessness that's going on, instigated by liberal, white liberal Democrats. These looters went in and they stole watches and very expensive things from the store, and they wiped it clean. And the owner of owners of the place were upset, obviously, because their business had been violated in that way. And the mayor of Chicago had the audacity to say that these businesses are at fault because they are not investing enough in security to prevent these things happening. So her reaction was not, "Oh, our policy of defunding the police and calling police evil and destructive and making life difficult for law enforcement." No, instead of saying that is what is triggering this, and therefore we should change our attitude towards police and towards law enforcement. Instead of that, she blamed it on the business, as if to say, "Hey, you should have, you should know that we are in difficult times, and you should get better security for your very exclusive shop or store." And that went to the point of what we were saying in the previous snippet, that the right to property should be declared in the new American Constitution in such a way that it is evident that you do not surrender the right to property if you leave your property with open access to anyone. So if you leave your house door open, that's not saying, hey, robbers come in and loot the place and take everything I own. You're not surrendering the right to property by just leaving your property available or exposed to people who want to take it away from you, because there's like a sacred shroud over your property. It's as if it has your name, even if you are not physically tagging it with your name. It has your name over it, and anyone who touches it and tries to take possession of it unlawfully or incorrectly when it's not theirs is drawing a curse on their lives. It is sacred in that sense. And if I have a convertible and I leave 100 Rolex watches on the back seat, and anyone could just go by and snatch them, even if I leave them out there in the open, that property is still to be respected. And anyone who takes those Rolex watches is accountable and should be punished according to the Constitution. And, but because the Constitution is so vague on these things, and so vague in this case to the point of not saying a single thing about the right to property, then we have idiots like Lori Bigfoot coming out and saying stupid things like that, that if we had a real constitution, we could go and everybody would go, wow, that was a stupid thing to say, because we would all have been kind of taught that the right to property is to be respected and upheld, and it's in our legal system. It would be part of our culture, part of our in automatic thinking, and we would say, wow, what an idiot. And that and a person who spoke like that would not be in power for long. But because we have such an ambiguous concept of the right to property from a legal standpoint, then we have people talking like that. But it was just, but the fact that this happened this week, one day after the snippet came out, is as if to say, hey, I'm reacting to what you're saying, hey, that the right to property is to be honored, even if I don't protect my property and invest extra effort to protect it. And it's as if Lori Bigfoot was saying, no. If you leave your house door open, then you're on your own, man. And any black brother and sister can come in and take everything they want, because it's owed to us anyway. So that was one interesting thing that happened this week. And the second thing that drew my attention is maybe not a headline, but something that I saw on television. And it's from an episode of Law and Order. It's an American television show from the 80s and 90s. And if you're not in the US, you might still have had a chance to watch it at some point. But I'm referring to the original Law and Order. That show has had a lot of spin-offs. But the one that I'm referring to is the original one that focused a lot more on the law aspect of things. Basically, the episodes are all about, people committing crimes and then the police coming and investigating the crime. And once they catch the suspect, then the suspect gets prosecuted, and you see the whole legal battle going on until the person is either convicted or acquitted. And even though it's a fictional show and the stories are fictional, it is very realistic in the way it portrays the legal system in America. So if you're ever interested in knowing how the legal system works or does not work in America, you can watch that show, the old reruns from the 80s and 90s, and you'll get a very, very strong, realistic sense of how things happen in the American legal system. And the episode that I watched this week was very interesting, because it had to do with some of the things we've discussed about the seventh pillar, which is the right to privacy. And it was the story of this young man who had AIDS. And remember, back in the 80s and 90s, this was AIDS was like a death sentence. it's not like that anymore, but back in those days, it was like a lethal thing. And this young man got AIDS, and he was still sleeping around with a lot of women, and he was being brazen about it. He just wanted to take as many women as he could with him. He was doing it just for the fun of it, and he even said that to one of his friends, and that's what the story was about. So the police got involved, and but they were not able to determine exactly who the person was, the identity of this man who was, in a sense, using himself as a biological weapon to destroy people on purpose. They were able to get enough information to more or less know who he was, but they needed one last piece. And that last piece of information needed to be provided by the health department of the state of New York, I guess, because the show is based on cases in New York City. So they went to the health department in this episode, the cops, and they wanted to get the information, the extra information they needed to get the exact name of this person to stop them, get them off the streets so that he wouldn't be infecting other people. And the worker there, the health department worker, would not give out the name, and she kept talking about privacy, the right to privacy, the confidentiality of medical records. And I kept thinking, oh yes, it's the same thing that we've had, the problem that we have defined the right to privacy to cover anything, and it's just to cover nakedness, as we've said before, not to cover wrongdoing. But the health worker was adamant about it, and I said to myself, what are they going to do about it? And the cops went to try to get they try to convince a judge to force the health department to give out the information they needed to identify the person. And they found a judge who was willing to do it. And when I saw it, as I was watching the episode, I said to myself, I wonder how long that decision by that judge will stand. And it might get overturned later on in the episode. And lo and behold, they used they were able to get this subpoena, you could say, to go get the information. They got the guy and they put him, in jail. And then they wanted to prosecute him. But as the prosecution of the fellow began, another judge, the defense, went to the judge and tried to get the information the cops had on his client removed from the trial because he said these cops violated his client's privacy by getting this information from the health department. And lo and behold, just as I anticipated, this judge reversed the other judge's decision and threw out that information and did not allow it to be included in the trial. And the weird thing is, as the cops, were angry about what was going on, and they were talking to the district attorney lawyers who were prosecuting this man. The district attorney lawyer, one of the prosecuting lawyers, said something to the effect, "Well, yeah, it's an issue of the right to privacy." And then the cop responded by saying, "No, well, she was saying it's about the right to privacy, it's the constitutional right, and this, that, and the other." And then the cop responded in anger and said, "Yes, but what about the right to life?" And I found, and that's, and then they cut off that exchange and moved on to something else. And that exchange was so interesting because we've been talking about all these things in these snippets about the right to life versus the right to and its connection or conflict with the right to privacy. But the fact that the cop was the one who said, "What about the right to life?" Because he was not an attorney, so he was speaking as a human being, thinking about the right to life of the people that this man was, this monster was infecting in the story. And then I said to myself, well, does the cop and do the people, the writers of this show realize that there is no right to life in the legal system? It's not there. Maybe it's in the laws, but not in the Constitution. It's not a constitutional right. But I found that very interesting, and how we have developed a system, because the right to privacy is so poorly defined in our Constitution, that we have allowed it to become large enough to cloud out other legitimate rights that are not even stated in the Constitution. So I found that very interesting. And while the trial was going on, the defense attorney kept talking about the constitutional rights of my client, the constitutional rights of my client. And I kept saying to myself, interesting, how this is just a perfect picture of how the constitutional rights that we have defined in the current Constitution are not real. Are not real rights, and we are giving people rights that they don't have from a metaphysical standpoint. Because as we've said before, these rights exist independent of us. It's a matter of us discovering these rights and trying to understand how they are. We don't define them. We have to portray them as they really are. We are like artists drawing a portrait of an object that's standing in front of us, and our task is to get the portrait to be as exact as the original. And so we are dealing with constitutional rights that don't exist in the real world. They just exist on paper, rights that are artificially created, that are actually distorting the entire legal system, our entire society. And as long as we keep worshiping the founding fathers and thinking that we have the perfect constitution and that we don't need to tamper with it, the longer this nonsense is going to go. And it's sad in my heart that I just don't see conservatives waking up. And if conservatives don't wake up and people don't wake up on a massive scale, then the country will... I don't know. There is no hope, it seems like, for this American nation. So that was very interesting, that episode, dealing with a lot of issues that we have talked about in the snippets, and how it illustrates that the right to privacy is all out of whack, because it's not well defined. And the cops saying, what about the right to life? You know, say, oh, yeah, there's a right that's clearly being violated, and the Constitution has absolutely jack to say about it. And I know the episode was fictitious, but I'm pretty sure that if it had been a real-life case, then a lot of the things that were portrayed on that episode would have happened in real life, all that exchange and the conflict, legal conflict that was going on, that was being described in that episode. So that's number two. The third thing that I wanted to share with you was this was not an episode. This was a real life story that I read, very touching this week, about a mother somewhere in the U.S. If I'm not mistaken. Who had this beautiful little girl? The story's kind of written by her, and she said that her beautiful little girl was very feminine and always dressed in pink and playing with dolls and all that, you know, things that you attribute to little girls. But I think it was around the age of 12 when suddenly something happened to the little girl, and she suddenly wanted to be a man. You know, this whole gender confusion thing that's been going on, this horrific thing that's happening in the world and in America. Apparently she began to be kind of seduced by people who were telling her things. And then eventually she had a lot of social media, you know, friends and things like that. And slowly, she turned into this nutcase, situation where she wanted to be a man and this and that. And the mother, you know, began to fight to rescue her daughter from that that whole thing, because she saw the transformation in her personality. She just turned into this other person in a very, very bad way. She was a sweet, loving young daughter, and then she turned into this horrible individual. And what caught my attention about the story is that she, the mother, talked about going into the daughter's bedroom and looking for stuff, and she broke into her social media accounts and started blocking a whole bunch of things and didn't allow her access to many things. And the daughter just started acting up, and it got really bad, and she hated her mother, but her mother just kept loving her and just restricting all that access to all that, all the bad influences in her life. And apparently after a few years, the daughter started turning around and was beginning to be set free from that horrible, horrible thing that was being done to her soul. And what caught my attention about the story was the fact that the woman was basically violating, if you can call it that, the right to privacy of her little daughter, you know, by breaking into her social media accounts and getting her passwords and things. And apparently the daughter would set up fake accounts and things like that. So they were doing this dance of her trying to maintain her privacy while her mother was encroaching on it. But it kind of pointed out what we were saying, that the right to privacy is a growing thing. You cannot... The right to privacy is associated to the concept of innocence. And when a person is in a state of innocence, they have little aware of their nakedness. And when they have little aware of their nakedness, they also have a limited right to privacy. But as they mature, as their innocence goes away, if you can say it that way, and they become aware of their nakedness, and their privacy circle begins to grow and grow, and that right to privacy then eventually matures into the fullness of what it is, you know, when you become an adult. But the fact that this woman, you know, was encroaching on the woman's young daughter's privacy kind of illustrates the fact that yes, when a person is young, they cannot claim the same right to privacy that an adult would claim. So if she was doing this to an adult person, that would be a clear violation. But she was doing it to her daughter, who was in the state of innocence and being seduced by all these things. And she was within her metaphysical right, and thankfully within her legal right. At least the legal system has not gotten corrupt enough to go after a mother like that. Not yet, I think. But if we had these things very clearly laid out in the Constitution, then we would be guaranteeing a safer future for ourselves and for our kids, if we had the Constitution protecting the innocence of kids. And we don't have that. We have the Constitution talking about not letting, allowing soldiers to sleep in your house if they want to. Oh yeah, awesome. Yeah, the Constitution is protecting me from that, but it's not really protecting us from other very real things that need to be explicitly plastered. And they get plastered as we start to think about the fundamental metaphysical rights. When you start thinking about the rights as principles, as things that are real and objective, that are out there, all these things start coming out, and they get plastered in a written, explicit form. And then we have a system, a legal system, that can protect us and that can create a prospering, safe, and righteous society. So that drew my attention. So the last two things we mentioned, the privacy thing with the Law and Order episode, and this privacy issue with the mother who was dealing with a daughter that had gender confusion, it kind of illustrates some of the things we were talking about when discussing the right to privacy, the seventh pillar of the new American Constitution. And the fourth and last thing that I wanted to mention in passing was a recent story that came out. It was an article that I was reading in this more or less conservative website that was talking about how the headline more or less said they are trying to federalize voter illegality, and they were talking about a bill that I think is called HR1 or something like that. And this horrible bill that is being promoted by the Democrats in America is basically trying to institutionalize voter fraud. They were able to steal the election in 2020 clearly. And now that they've been able to do that, and now they have all these thieves, all these frauds in power, they're trying to make it a permanent thing by instituting all these extra laws that will make it practically impossible to stop voter fraud in the future. I don't remember a lot of the exact details, but for example, one of the things, if I'm not mistaken, that they want to do is that that bill would include laws preventing or making it illegal to require any sort of identification when you go to vote. Which is, when you think about it, it's ridiculous, even in third world countries. And everybody who, with a little bit of common sense knows, yeah, you have to show some form of ID when you go to vote. It's just natural. But apparently they don't, but they are demanding the so-called vaccine passports, the rape by injection passports that you have to show to be able to eat indoors in many places in the U.S. at the time of this recording. But to go to vote, hey, you know, just show up and say you are someone and just go in there and vote Democrat. Another thing they want to do is they want to create some sort of national ID. But we have said in these snippets that that is a thing that conservatives have stupidly fought against. So you would think, well, if Democrats are promoting it, maybe it is a bad idea. Yeah, it is a bad idea, but in the way that they are promoting it. The reason why they want a national kind of more or less a national driving license, in a sense, is not because of the reasons that we have stated or tried to state in these snippets. The reason is more that they want to be able to allow illegal aliens to vote more easily, because that has been the mechanism that's been used in at the state level. At the state level, and like in California and other places, illegal aliens can go and get driver's licenses. And once they get driver's licenses, it's like they get a foot in the door of, you know, the legal system. And a lot of times they automatically get registered to vote when they get their driving license. And I've heard stories of immigrants, even, you know, legal immigrants, legal immigrants as well, who have gotten things in the mail about, you know, voter ballots to vote, and even though they are foreigners. And it's because in many states like California, you automatically sometimes get registered to vote, even if you were not a citizen of the country. And what the Democrats want to do is to kind of make that nationwide so that it will be easier for illegal aliens to get entered into the voter rolls or whatever they're called. So they can go and vote and vote illegally. Like, and by the way, like in New York City, I think, I don't know if it's already been passed, but they were talking about allowing illegal aliens to vote, and it's okay, and no one can stop it. And what bothered me about this story was not so much what the Democrats tried to do. What bothered me, well, that bothered me a great deal, but what bothered me on top of that was the headline that the conservative who wrote the article put. He said, basically, he was hinting that by giving the voter rules to the federal government, we are going to institutionalize voter fraud, and therefore it's his backdoor way of saying, hey, we have been saved from fraud through federalism. And now that we are removing the power, the voting rules from the state and giving them to the federal government, then now all hell will break loose. In other words, it was a backhanded way of defending federalism. But then again, we go back to what we've said over and over again. We would not be in this mess if it weren't for federalism. Federalism allowed this to happen because the Founding Fathers stupidly said in the Constitution very clearly that the states are the ones who have the sovereignty to decide election regulations and rules. So they decide, all the rules on who can vote, how they can vote, and this, that, and the other. And because every state can do it on its own, then they've been able to kind of do a lot of shenanigans in individual states. When 2020 happened, what the Democrats did is they picked certain key states, battleground states, and said, we're going to commit fraud in this state, this state, this state. And because the election itself is localized, then they were able to circle their wagons and protect themselves from public view and do all these things in the dark, because the Democrats controlled a lot of the machinery inside the state, and they could do all these things in the dark because no one was looking from the outside over what they were doing, because there's no centralized regulation of voting laws in the country, because it's embedded in the Constitution. So that's why they were able to do the fraud that they committed. And yes, some states help other states, like the state of New York, through that son of a bitch, Andy Cuomo, the so-called governor who was there and has now been ejected. He was coordinating with people in Georgia and people in Michigan and people in Pennsylvania and helping, even sending, delivering ballots to the other states so that they could fill them up and commit the fraud. So there was coordination at the national level, if you can call it that. But the fraud itself happened at the local level, supported and shielded by federalism. And now, if the election results will never be overturned, they were never legal to begin with. The son of a bitch was shuffling his feet in the White House at the time of this recording. It's not a legitimate elected man. He's a little bastard boy who will die, hopefully, in the next couple of months and then burn in hell for all of eternity and suffer greatly, greatly. And so this little son of a bitch will not be removed except by a severe judgment and condemnation from office. He will not be removed from power through the legal system, because to do that you have to fight at every state separately. You have to go fight in Arizona. You have to go fight in Georgia. You have to go fight in Pennsylvania. You have to go fight in Michigan. And you can't do a global fight because all the elections are localized. So you can't decertify the election at the nation level through a national strategy, because you have to go fight in every state. And so in every state, sometimes you'll win, sometimes you'll lose. And in this case, we're losing in every state because the whole system is rigged and the Constitution has nothing to protect voter integrity. The Founding Fathers, who were such geniuses in recognizing the corruption in human nature, as conservatives always say, these geniuses, it didn't occur to them that there could possibly be voter fraud down the road. Wow, what geniuses. So what bothered me about this story was that the conservatives sees the HR1 bill as a sign that, yeah, we need to maintain federalism to protect us from widespread corruption. But no, yeah, obviously, this is not to take away federalism, HR1. It is to basically keep federalism, with local fraud at the local level. The state's defining their own rules, but then they're just adding this. It's like having like all these piles of excrement, and they're just adding a coating of frosting on top of all the piles that covers all the piles. That's basically what the HR1 does, adding these extra little laws that allow states to continue with their internal corruption. It is not a dismantling of the federalized system of voting, and then instituting a set of clear, well-structured rules that will monitor against voting fraud at the national level and protect election integrity. There is no monitoring of what's going on, like what was happening in several states where they stopped counting votes. And what they were doing is they needed to know how many votes they needed, how many fake ballots they needed to punch into the system. And then they came back online and continued because they had all the fake ballots ready. You know, how many do we need? So we have to stop counting and see how many we need. And a lot of times, as people have reported, the voting count on television would suddenly change. Like suddenly, like 10,000 votes would go from Trump back to bite me, and people took screenshots of this on television, television screenshots and this, but all you can do is just share the screenshot with a friend and moan and weep. Then nothing can be done about it because there is no centralized monitoring. You know, it's like in third world countries where there has been a history of corruption, they send the UN, when it had a little bit of more integrity than now, they would send these observers to observe the election and monitor things and then report, you know, to the UN and say, hey, yeah, we saw these irregularities and we saw this, that, the other. There's none of that in the U.S. And we could have, we have had 200 and how many, 50 years of democracy, and we never were able to establish a clear system to ensure election integrity. And it's all because of federalism. That's the root of it. And for them to have a conservative say, oh no, we need more federalism. It is like the crazy liberals who have the rape by injections, growing and growing, and instead of the virus dying out, the cases keep growing and growing, and then the Omicron variant comes out, and all the people who got Omicron have been raped by injection or so-called vaccinated. And yes, the studies show that the rape by injection does not deal with the Omicron virus, the variant. And the solution from politicians is, oh, we need more vaccination. Yes, but the vaccination does not deal with the Omicron variant. No. The fact that there's Omicron out there means that we need to protect ourselves more. How can we protect ourselves? By injecting ourselves with this experimental stuff that does not work against, it doesn't matter that it doesn't work. We need more of it. So it's the same thing with conservatives. Federalism and all these other things are destroying the country. And instead of them realizing, hey, you know, I think we should stop and analyze what we're doing and thinking and realize, no, the founding fathers might have been very good men and all that, but they made mistakes, fundamental mistakes, mistakes that only a moron would make. And we have to stop following the moronic pillars that they left that are sinking us and sinking us and sinking us. And so instead of destroying these pillars, we want to reinforce them, which is maddening to no end to me, and discouraging. The sadness in my heart, seeing the destruction, the self-destruction of this country, and conservatives who could spearhead the restoration of this nation are still trapped in idiocy. and we're not waking up, so there is very little hope. Now that I've said that, and one more thing that I do believe we have to say is regarding the we have a constitution that protects the Fifth Amendment, the right to remain silent. And this Fifth Amendment, for example, is another thing that has caused so much destruction. It is a manifestation of the right to privacy in a very twisted way. And it's a way to shield wrongdoing from prosecution. And we have, and we'll talk about this more in another audio snippet in more detail. But the Fifth Amendment in the American Constitution says that you cannot be forced to witness against yourself, you know, self-incriminating testimony. And that has devolved into the Miranda rights, which really are an outgrowth of that Fifth Amendment. And it was an unnatural outgrowth in a sense. That came out in the 20th century, many years after the Constitution had been written, but it's a consequence of it, and we have this stupid scenario in the American legal system where I can confess my crime, and then get arrested, and what I said will be held against me because I said it right before I got arrested, but if I am arrested, then. If I say the same thing I would have said, you know, just before the arrest, then and I wasn't read my Miranda rights, which means that I was warned that everything I say can and will be used against me in a court of law, and somebody forgot the technicality of reading me the so-called Miranda rights, then any confession I may make is thrown out, and I'm not forced to testify to take the witness stand to answer questions from the prosecution in front of the jury, and to me it's puzzling. Who was the idiot who came up with the Fifth Amendment? Who was the idiot? Where's the metaphysical foundation for that right, so-called right? And it's a right that's defended tooth and nail in the American constitutional, you know, legal system, and it's an aberration of the truth. There is no right to remain silent. That is a made-up American thing, American stupidity. And it's become a shield for wrongdoing. It's like saying, I'm going to keep my wrongdoing private, and I am not forced to reveal it. It's my right to privacy, again, being manifested in the wrong way. And the senselessness of it. And I will share with you another episode later on that I saw this week of Law and Order. Maybe I'll do it right now. It was about this man who was holding a woman hostage with a knife, on her neck. And he was saying, I want a lawyer. And if not, I'm going to kill this woman. And they sent a lawyer. But it was not a lawyer to on his behalf. It was a lawyer from the district attorney's office, and she tried to convince him, you know, to put the knife down and all that. And then the episode was about her being prosecuted because she deceived the knife guy. She deceived him into thinking that she was a lawyer on her behalf. And that everything he said had to be thrown out, because she had not read him his Miranda rights, but it was a life and death situation, and she had to go in by herself into the store where the guy had the hostage, and she was risking her life because the guy with the knife could have just lunged at her and killed her too, and she very wisely. Calmed him down and was able to get him to surrender. But then the guy said, my rights, my constitutional rights have been violated. and the whole episode was about the legal controversy. She was going to get disbarred in the episode. And you may say, oh, this is all fictional, but it was very realistic. And it just goes to the lunacy of our legal system. And it not because of the Democrats, it's because of the founding fathers who left this Fifth Amendment thing, this stupidity. So even though, so in other words, if I want a lawyer and I want counsel, even if I'm doing it while committing a crime, then any interaction that happens there is protected by the Fifth Amendment, which is ridiculous. And they were even talking, the defense was even saying, hey, he had an expectation of privacy. And there was the woman who was being held at knife point was there listening, and his rights to privacy were being violated. Well, he had her at knife point. She had no way of getting away. But what I'm trying to say is that the lunacy of the right to privacy and the Fifth Amendment and all these things that are embedded in the constitutional system of this country that need to be just extirpated. But to do that, we have to admit that the founding fathers got it all wrong. And I don't know how long it will be before that will happen. Maybe a couple of years of more insanity and destruction. And I hope that by then it won't be too late. Now we'll start talking a little bit about the eighth pillar. And we'll just do a quick recap. We're running out of time. So we had mentioned that the right to property should involve the ability or the right to acquire property through work or effort. And one thing that's important to point out in that is that when that gets written out in the New American Constitution, it will be necessary to emphasize that no restriction should be placed on the accumulation of property, on the basis of accumulation per se. In other words, we have a kind of even though it's not written anywhere, we have this unwritten rule that a lot of people seem to accept that it's wrong for someone to have too much money. And once someone has too much money, then we have to find a way to take it away from him or her. Because there are people dying in Africa, and how dare he have all this money when there are people out there who need it. And the Constitution should be very clear that if I have acquired it, property through work and effort in an honest way, then it would be any law that attempts to take that property just because I have too much of it, that law should be unconstitutional, and that should be very clearly stated in the Constitution. We have to get out of this horrible mentality we have about people not being allowed to be too wealthy. One of the reasons why it's important to have wealthy people in society is that they are able to accumulate a lot of resources and then engage in a lot of economies of scale. Because they have so much money, then they can make these large investments that require a large initial, spending of money to build. Let's say if you want to build a car factory, that takes a lot of money. You have to pull together a whole bunch of money and get all the machinery, and while you're doing all that, you're losing money. But once you're able to get all the sophisticated technology, then you can start producing cars in a very fast and efficient way. So in the long term, you will make your money back, and society benefits because the cars are being produced more efficiently. And can you imagine how costly it would be for society if every car was handmade by one person, and one person had to put the whole car together on his own? We would just have like 5 cars a year being produced, and that'd be extremely expensive. But because we have all this, all these machinery that does it, then the cars can roll out, in great quantities in a very inexpensive way because of economies of scale. And that's only possible because someone had a lot of money to invest to put together the complicated machinery and expensive machinery that can then produce these cars in a very inexpensive way. And if we take away that, the ability of people to accumulate a lot of wealth, then the only one who ends up accumulating a lot of wealth is the government. If I look at Cuba, you know, everybody's poor, everybody driving, the few people who can drive anything are driving 50s, Chevys from the 1950s or, old cars in dilapidated buildings. So everybody's poor, there's no one rich, and the only one who has absolute wealth was, Fidel Castro when the son of a bitch was alive. He's now burning in hell, thankfully. He's screaming right now as we're speaking in horror and torment. He was the only one who had billions of dollars, and he had like some hidden accounts in Switzerland and stuff. But even if it's not just one person becoming wealthy in the government, the government itself is very powerful, accumulating all these resources and then redistributing it to the people. So when the government is the one who is pulling together a lot of resources, then we have a problem because government is not designed for efficiency. Government's not thinking about the most efficient way to produce something because it has nothing to risk. So it invests in a lot of foolish things that have no use. That's what kept happening in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union kept producing, the Soviet government had a lot of resources, and they were producing steel and a lot of things. And you looked at the numbers, and it would say, oh, wow, what a productive economy. But they were producing things that no one was using. So they were just producing steel for the sake of producing steel, just to have the statistic that they were producing a lot of steel, but no one was using the steel to build anything because it was not driven by supply and demand, the so-called invisible hand of Adam Smith. So to them, having a whole bunch of extra steel lying around didn't cost the government anything because the government was not risking anything in doing this. So they were just wasting all these resources. So when you give when the only one who can pull a lot of resources together is the government, then you create a system where you have a lot of inefficiencies. So we have to make it very clear in the Constitution, no one can pass a law that tries to limit people's wealth just because they have too much. That on its own should not be grounds for taking away a person's property. And that is different from the issue of antitrust laws, and we'll talk about that later, especially with the last pillar, the 10th pillar. That is different because that's at the company level. That's not at the individual level. That's at the company level. And we have mentioned that companies are entities, virtual entities, and that's why they shouldn't be taxed, because whenever a company makes money, it's just money that's sitting in some bank account that no one can handle. It's until that money becomes the revenue to an individual, that's when it should be taxed. And so the Constitution will make a very strong distinction between the individual and the company, and companies are treated in a different way. And they cannot be taxed. They will not be taxed because that leads to the principle of double taxation that should be unconstitutional. But also, and just as they are not taxed, they can also be challenged when they are becoming too big. But we'll talk about that later. So that was the first thing. The Constitution saying that we making it very clear that we have the right to acquire property through work and effort, and that it cannot be restricted. No one can envy us and say, you have too much, you will take some money away from you. So that's number one. The second thing is that we can acquire property through an honest exchange of goods and services. So the first principle there is, yes, you can accumulate wealth through effort, through your work and your effort, and whatever you accumulate is yours. And it's sacred in that sense. We can't just come and take it away from you. The second thing is enabling commerce, to make it clear, yes, you can acquire property through an honest exchange of goods and services. So you, I give you this and you give me that, and now this is mine because I gave you this other thing. So that's a constitutional declaration. Yes, commerce is protected by the Constitution. And you may say, oh, that's a very simple thing, but these simple things become so important when we play things out in real life. If we are fundamentally sound, then we can be successful. So that's number two. The third thing we said is the right to property involves the right to give, to gift your property to whomever you please. In other words, the right to be charitable to whomever you want. If you want to give all your money away to Fido the dog, and whoever will take care of little Fido, that's your thing. It's your money. You can give it to Fido if you want. And no one can say, oh, you can't do that. Well, yes, I can. It's my money, and I can do whatever I want with it. And I want to give it to Fido, and Fido will have the best food that a dog could possibly have. Then it's my choice. So that's a third principle. A fourth principle is the right not to transfer your property to someone else for a price that you do not deem to be fair. In other words, just as you can give away your money to whomever you want, the Constitution will also protect your right not to give it to anyone if you don't want to. So just as it protects commerce, if you want to engage in commerce, the Constitution will say, yes, you can engage in commerce, the trading of goods and services with others. But at the same time, if you don't want to do the commerce, then you are constitutionally protected to do so. So in other words, no one can force me to buy something I don't want to buy. And that should be in the Constitution. And that's very clearly, that would come in very handy nowadays with the mandate that Obastrop and liberals like the son of a bitch Phil Murphy, worthless little tramp that lives in Trenton, New Jersey, that they have enforced health insurance mandates on people. So I, for example, I have to pay thousands of dollars in fines every year because I refuse to buy health insurance. And it's just the thing. Either you buy this, or we're going to fine you $2,000 to $3,000 a year. And the fine has been going up every year. And the worthless son of a bitch is accumulating judgment with every dollar he takes away from me. And he will burn in hell, and every dollar that he took from me will add to his torment. So in that sense, I do rejoice. Now you have to pay interest on the penalty that they charge me at the end of the year, because I'm supposed to pay the penalty every 3 months. So I have to kind of prorate the penalty and pay it during the year. And I say, no, this penalty is morally wrong. So at the end of the year, they charge me interest for the penalty that they could only ascertain until the end of the year, as if they were expecting me to not comply throughout the year. It's just lunacy. But if we had something in the Constitution that said, no, you have the right not to exchange in commerce if you don't want to, then I could go and say, hey, the Constitution says I'm not forced to buy that if I don't want to. And that is very different from, let's say, a situation where someone is required to have their car in good condition in order to drive, like they have broken headlights, and then the government would say, well, you can't drive, or we'll penalize you if we stop you and you have your headlights broken, and we have warned you or whatever. That is a little bit of a different situation, but it starts getting iffy when you go down that road as well. But in that scenario, you could say, well, at least it's different because if you if you have a car with broken headlights and you refuse to buy the headlights for some reason and repair the headlights, you can still take the bus or do something else. You can continue existing. But in this case, health insurance, for example, in America, is being forced on people. So just by me existing, I'm supposed to be buying health insurance just out of existence. Even if I've not I have not needed health services for decades, other than the regular maintenance. But I've been very fortunate and very grateful that I in that sense I've been. I have never needed it, but the government is saying, no, you will have to finance this corrupt system, health system that we have in this country, and feed the monster to artificially increase demand to make, which causes medical costs to skyrocket. And we'll maybe talk about that in a future snippet. We have already discussed it before, but we need to discuss it in greater detail, how we have had this vicious cycle of medical costs skyrocketing because we create artificial demand for it because it's all tied to insurance. And it's ridiculous. I don't know who was the idiot who came up with this, but I guess it all started with Polio Boy when he began to force us to link employment to insurance, health insurance. And that began the spiral that now has us spending 1/6 of our GDP in health insurance and in healthcare, which would make you think, for crying out loud, Americans must be dropping dead all over the place because they are so sick that they have to spend one out of every $6 in health insurance, in healthcare. And that's not the case. It's just that it's so incredibly expensive because we have a corrupt system, and none of that would be happening if we had a constitution that protected the right to property in a better way. So that's the fourth thing we mentioned, and I'm sorry for recapping, but I believe it's important to repeat these things, and we'll continue with the other things, and I was hoping to get to some new things, but apparently this was not the day to do that. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope that as you are hearing these things, that these rights and these concepts are becoming clearer and clearer. I know that in these snippets we sometimes say things in a roundabout way, maybe out of order. But I know, and I hope, and I do believe, and I trust that someday that these things will be plastered somehow in the new American Constitution in a very clear and distinct way. And maybe America's waiting for some white prince riding in a white horse to come and say the same things and then believe them. I don't know what America is waiting for, but whether it will be through these snippets or in some other way, these principles are being set out there, and they will take hold, and they will be plastered in a new American Constitution. And whether they the source of these things is ever remembered, that is secondary. But I do believe that someday someone out there that America will listen to will say these things, and they will be written down, and we'll have a new system that will launch us into a different era where truth will be king, where truth will finally come down to earth and be the king of the land instead of the nonsense that we have with conservatives clinging to the past and liberals running towards the cliff with the accelerator all the way down to the lowest point possible. So thank you very much for listening.